Hello, I'm Victor Nirenberg, and this is SciTech File on Radio Canada International. This week on SciTech File, part one of the science of the record. The digital age creates a memory blank, and risks of biodiversity to flowers and plants. Not enough pollinators to go around. When God handed Moses the Ten Commandments on stone tablets, he or she was onto something. Information carved in stone has staying power. Consider if instead of stone, those commandments had been electronically embedded on a floppy disk. Given the inherent obsolescence of computer technology, those commandments would have been irretrievable after just a few years. Can your new laptop read a floppy? And even if you could have retrieved them, would there have been any way to authenticate them? They may look like the Ten Commandments, but how can you be sure they're the real thing? The fact is, the digital era has created a problem that has never existed before. How do you authenticate as original something created in a computer? And how can you preserve it for future generations when the technology that created it will, with absolute certainty, cease to exist? It is a huge and complex problem, but it is being tackled. Led by Dr. Luciana Durante, Chair of Archival Studies at the University of British Columbia, InterParis has taken up the challenge. InterParis, or International Research on Permanent Authentic Records in Electronic Systems, comprises numerous scholars across many disciplines from 20 countries. They include Canada, the United States, the UK, China, Australia, the Netherlands, Italy, and Botswana. The problem of record keeping in the digital age first came to Dr. Durante's attention back in 1993 when an American historian successfully sued the White House after a Freedom of Information request for an original document led to the release of a computer printout. In the precedent-setting court case, the judge agreed with the historian and ruled the printout was not the original, not an official document. It was just a copy. At that point, the U.S. Defense Department turned to Luciana Durante for help in developing a system of preserving and authenticating the digital record. That, in turn, led to InterParis. Today on SciTech File, we present the first of two installments of my conversation with Dr. Durante, starting with a look back to not so many years ago, when the official record was stored on paper, or film, or any other non-digital medium.
We did have conservation problems because, of course, the medium deteriorates. But we had, at the end, whatever materiality of the record existed in the beginning. So, for example, we could examine the authenticity of a record on the record itself. We would analyze the medium, the ink, the form of the record, the signature. Now, because with digital material, the original disappears in the moment in which we save the record for the first time because it breaks down in all of its digital parts. And every time we recall it, we create a copy, which is never identical to the previous one. Then we can no longer say that something is authentic or not. We have to find other ways of inferring that something is authentic.
Well, just explain to me why when you retrieve a digital record, it is not exactly the same as the original.
Well, that's because of the way the system works. When you save a record, the bit strings go into the hard drive, or you may save it on a disk or wherever. But that's not the record. That's just the bit strings. In order to be able to get the record, you have to have the operating system and the software transform that bit string again in a specific logical structure, and so that you see on the screen what you had the first time. But the fact is that that operation never happens in an absolute identical way. So there is something that always changes
But not necessarily to the eye of the casual user.
Not necessarily to the eye of the casual reader. That's true. Although we know very well, for example, that if I send you an email, I see it on my screen in a certain form, but often you see it in a completely different form.
The content is the same, but the document is not the same.
That's right. So this is all nice and well when what you have is a text message. But if what you have is a table and the column starts moving around, then all your information is wrong. And if what you have is a map and the colors come out different, your information is different.
In the paper age, when you created a document and you had to update the document, you would likely create a second document.
Absolutely.
So you would leave what they call in law a paper trail.
That's right. Or you would delete what you have in a clear, evident way and write over it. We know that in the past, even with the parchment, the palimpsest, with the parchment, they used to delete the text and write again using the same parchment, but we are able to read the text under. That's the way we were able to read the works of Cicero, for example. All the Republica had been totally deleted, but was retrieved by reading under the subsequent script. So, in fact, we had the ability to preserve the information attached to a medium. Now, the problem is that we cannot preserve any digital record. The only thing we can do is to preserve our ability to regenerate a record as close enough as we can to the first one. And what is also happening, especially with GIS systems, geographic information systems, in which data are assembled according to some geographic pattern, what happens is that the data are constantly overwritten. So when decisions are made on the basis of what one sees on the screen at one given point in time, an hour later, you can no longer justify that decision on what you see on that same screen because the information has changed.
So documents in the digital age are in a constant state of flux. So
unless we make a special effort to freeze them.
I presume that that's what you're trying to do.
Well, it's not that simple because when we're dealing with traditional, now we're already talking about traditional digital records, you understand? When we're dealing with traditional digital records like databases, we know how to deal with that. We can freeze whatever we view and save it as an image. But when we're dealing with dynamic and interactive records whose nature and whose usefulness is in the interactivity, is in the ability to change all the time and to react to the user queries. If we freeze those records, we basically change their nature. We forge them. And they're not longer useful anyway because their usefulness is in the interactivity, is in the dynamicity. So what we are trying to do is also to develop methodologies to preserve those records in a dynamic status, but in a way to preserve all the history of their changes. So what we freeze is not the record, it's the history of the change. A practical example is the city of Vancouver has a beautiful, wonderful system that is called the Van Map. It is a geographic information system which has a public side and a restricted side. The public side, any citizen can see on the computer. And basically, this is a map of Vancouver that has more than 100 layers in which one can see whatever one wishes to see. For example, I want to see where dog licenses are and who has them. So you click on that layer and you see on the map of Vancouver in that moment where all the licenses for dogs are, or where the sewers are, or where the parks are, whatever. On the restricted side, there is much more information. It's the same system, but it has information that is normally should not be accessible to anyone. And that is used by the city employees to make their decisions. Now, because the data that create this wonderful system come from all the offices of the city and also some of the offices of the province, and they come in a constant flow, and they constantly are updated, but in different times. So, for example, from one office, they are updated every hour. From another office, they're updated every week. And from another, yet every minute. Then every time you look at the map, you see something different. Now, if you freeze that map, basically it's useless, because all the advantage is to be able to move from a layer to another and compare also. In a way, we have no history of what the situation was at any given time. What we want to be able to do is to say, I want to know exactly what was the situation of the traffic in Vancouver on the 6th of January 2004. Because in order to make decisions on how to reorganize it, I want to be able to compare that situation with 1 year later. So that's what we're trying to do. And the way we do this is we look at the situation, we look at the procedures of the employees and that they need in order to be able to act and to be efficient, and possible additional needs. We make hypotheses on what we should get at the end, what are the entities that we need to preserve on the basis of diplomatic methodology. Now, diplomatics is a very old discipline that was developed in the 17th century to identify records of unknown origin. But that is the basic of the science of the record. So on that basis, we define what entities we need to have at the end. Then we make a model, a kind of data flow and activity flow of what the deal situation that we have to create is. And then on the basis of technological knowledge of our co-investigators who are computer scientists, for example, we build a prototype and we see whether that works, whether it provides exactly what we need to have. And then we try to simulate the preservation over time and the possibility for access. Now, this is relatively simple because we are dealing with a situation in the public sector which is increasingly common, which, because we are dealing with the public sector and with large organizations, is possible to modify with structured procedures. Where the difficulty is when we are dealing with the arts, for example, or we are dealing with science and scientific research. Because with the arts, you have a completely different situation, not only artist by artist, but work by work in the context of the artist's work. So you can't just build a prototype and apply it to all the situations. Basically, every case is a case in itself. That means that if you establish a standard, you are basically eliminating the creativity of the artist. And if you don't, you are unable to preserve the work of the artist. Because increasingly, the works of the artist are interactive and are dynamic and are constituted of multiple parts that are in many different applications, and basically are going to be lost within 5 years.
That does pose a problem. Imagine our world if Mozart's creations had been lost after just 5 years, or Rembrandt's, or the recipe for pizza. Next week on SciTech File, we continue our conversation with Luciana Durante as she addresses some of the possible ways of preserving the official record of the digital era for future generations. In the meantime, you can check out the InterParis website and the City of Vancouver's Van Map. You'll find the links on the SciTech File website at rcinet.ca/SciTechFile. You're listening to SciTech File on Radio Canada International. Flowers are beautiful creatures. They can brighten up a field or forest as easily as they can light up our days. Some, you may have remarked, are more beautiful than others, or at least more showy. They can be brighter, more colorful, more ornate or elaborate. Some are tall, others short. As with everything else in nature, there's usually a reason for all that. In much the same way that animal species, including humans, try to be attractive to suitors, plants, too, need some adoring attention to keep their species alive. They need pollinators, like birds, bees, or butterflies, to reproduce. Those pollinators are among the so-called vectors that carry the pollen from one plant to another. What they don't eat themselves as their source of protein and other nutrients, they unwittingly but conveniently carry to the next plant they visit, and that's how the plant is fertilized. But what if those birds and bees and butterflies are faced with an embarrassment of riches? So many flowers, so little time. Add to that a decline in their numbers, and you have some species of flowers being ignored. Canadian biologist Jana Vamosi has discovered that plant life in some of the world's most lush gardens is under just that kind of stress. Flowers and tropical trees are, in some cases, not getting the attention they need from pollinators to perpetuate their species. That raises serious concerns, not only for the plants and animals that enjoy and depend on this symbiotic relationship, but also for we humans who depend on some of those threatened plant varieties, for many of the pharmaceuticals that sustain us. In an apparent paradox, Dr. Vamosi's study also revealed that in areas of the world where there is less biodiversity, where the gardens are not as lush and varied, the plant life is doing very well, thank you very much.
We found that species in more species-rich environments have much higher probability of being pollen-limited than species in less species-rich environments. And species-rich environments are also commonly known as our biodiversity hotspots of the world. A lot of the tropical areas are definitely hotspots and have a lot of species per unit area, but some areas aren't necessarily tropical and have a lot of species richness as well. A lot of trouble in South Africa, which is an extremely species-rich environment, and also in Southeast Asia and Costa Rica. Those were probably the hot spots for pollen limitation, and they're also places in the world that are extremely species-rich as well. One of the possibilities that comes from this data is that those areas that have many plant species per unit area are definitely sharing pollinators. They share a common pollinator pool, and that might be adding an extra layer of complexity to the problem because there could be pollinator declines in these areas, and they might be more severe than in areas with fewer species. People have been worried about whether our pollinators are experiencing decreases in diversity and abundance for quite some time. The effects of those pollinator declines is going to be greater in areas where there's more plant species, and those pollinators definitely are playing a very important and integral role to keeping the ecosystems in balance.
How does a botanist determine if a plant is suffering from pollen deficiency? Well, what they do is feed a particular plant with as much pollen as it can handle. Then they quantify how much fruit it bears in that state of satiation. That gives them a baseline. Then they measure how much fruit that same species is actually bearing in its natural surroundings. If that amount is lower, then it's deemed to be pollen limited. But how significant is that? Is a plant ever as well nourished in nature as it is when spoon-fed by a scientist?
Well, that's the big question. Do some plants experience pollen limitation naturally? Is it a naturally occurring event, especially when they're in environments where they share species with many, they share pollinators, sorry, with many different species? It could be a naturally occurring event, and it could lead to them evolving to have different features that attract perhaps different pollinators that can specialize in pollinators. And it could actually be the reason why we have so many species in, say, tropical areas. And it could be a long-standing evolutionary relationship where biodiversity sort of feeds upon itself and has a positive feedback loop. So that's definitely something that we're going to have to try to tease apart in future studies as well.
One cannot necessarily jump to the conclusion that there is a problem here. This may be part of the life cycle.
Absolutely correct. There could be other possibilities as well. It could be something such as pollinator declines aren't caused by habitat destruction, but they might be caused by mite infections, fungal infections, all sorts of things. You're limited only by your imagination and curiosity. There could definitely be others.
The evidence from the hundreds of individual studies Dr. Mimosi reviewed clearly points to pollen limitation among many of the species in question, at least as compared with that baseline ideal. What is not yet clear is whether this limitation is static or whether it is progressing over time.
We don't know whether this is a pattern that is extremely recent. There might be ways that where we can look deeper into the data set and see what year the pollen limitation study was performed in and examine whether more recent studies are showing greater amounts of pollen limitation. That's one future avenue to do. It also lends itself very well to probably experimental analysis, where we're going to have to look at areas that have been seeing some habitat disturbance versus areas that haven't, and examine whether pollen limitation differs in those two environments as well. As per usual with studies, they definitely open up more questions than they, in fact, answer. And this is no different. We still haven't got to the root of the problem, necessarily.
If the root of the problem remains to be unearthed, what is clear is the shortage of sufficient numbers of pollinators for whatever reason, whether nature itself or because of human activity. So it's not surprising that, as a consequence, some flowers and trees are feeling their absence.
Plants do compete for pollinator visits. And they do that in areas of high species richness to a higher degree. Pollinators just aren't necessarily the most loyal visitors. When they visit one plant species, in order for effective pollen delivery to occur, the next plant species that pollinator visits should be a member of the same species. That's how pollen delivery occurs. Now, when pollinators in species-rich areas perform their visits, that next individual that it visits on the following visit is less likely to be a member of the same species.
So from an evolutionary perspective, if you were a plant, you'd be a lot better off in an area where there is not this great biodiversity. Better to be the big fish in the small pond.
Yes, precisely. That's a great way of saying it. Unless plant species can evolve some mechanism by which they become the big species, perhaps having the showiest floral display might be one way, having the richest nectar, or evolving some sort of mechanism by which they're effectively winning the competition in terms of attracting pollinator visits. And so it could be a reason why we see some species in the tropics with such ornate floral display.
So the next time you wander through a flower garden, spend a few moments with the more modest varieties. Chances are they could use a little love. Jana Vimosi is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Calgary. Her study is published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. We close our show this week by answering a couple of questions about human vision. The first question is, why do we continue to see an outline of an object we've been staring at after we close our eyes? And number two, why do we sometimes see colors after rubbing our eyes? To answer these insightful queries, Quirks and Quarks host Bob McDonald turned to Dr. Paul Criss. He's an optometrist in Toronto, associated with the Vision Institute of Canada.
What's happening? happening there is that when a light is shone into the eye, it stimulates some of the photoreceptors, but not all of them. And when you close the eye and the stimulus is taken away, the photoreceptors that haven't been stimulated appear to be still on, and the ones that have been were activated by the light have become desensitized, and you still will get an impression, sometimes even in a complementary color, of the object that was or the light that was shone in the eye.
Oh, you mean like the ones that were working got tired? So it's a relative thing here.
Exactly.
So it sounds like what you're talking about here is like a negative, because it's the ones that were not on that appear to be on.
Well, you use a very good word. You use the word relative. And imagine that you're applying a lot of light to one photoreceptor and not to the other one. When that one has been tired, it looks like the other photoreceptor is much stronger in comparison, and so it is functioning at a higher level than the ones that were desensitized.
Ah, and it'll leave an outline.
Exactly.
And then finally, this thing about seeing colors when you close your eyes. I remember doing that when I was a kid. I used to lie with my face down and put my fist into my eyes and see colors. What's going on there?
Well, what you're doing basically is by rubbing the eye, you're really mechanically stimulating the retina. And that's just creating electrical impulses that travel down the optic nerve to the brain and create a sense of light and colors and flashes. It's just pure mechanical stimulation of the retina.
Really? Just physically shaking them causes them to...
Exactly, yep. Yeah, that's why we get sometimes when we get hit on the side of the head and it can mechanically stimulate the retina, you get these little flashes.
Dr. Chris, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dr. Paul Chris is an optometrist associated with the Vision Institute of Canada. He spoke with Bob McDonald, the host of the CBC Science Show, Quirks and Quarks. Well, that's our program for this week. My thanks to associate producer Roman Pitt, our studio technician today, Patrick Knupp. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email address is scitechfile@rcinet.ca. Our postal address is SciTechFile, Radio Canada International, Post Office Box 6000, Montreal, Canada. The postal code is H3C3A8. I'm Victor Nirenberg. Thank you for joining us.